Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Are you somebody who's got ADHD, who's looking for a coach to help you guide you through your ways? Well, my next guest is an ADHD coach with a different perspective. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage and let's learn more about him. See you there.
I wanna believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking, bottle up my intuition till it's popping out the box that I don't fit in. I wanna believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking.
Hang on. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today I'm joined with Shane, who is an ADHD coach. Welcome to the show, Shane.
Thank you for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
Not a problem. So let's start off with, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am a 43-year-old father of four. I've got a twin 5-year-olds, and I've got a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old. I have ADHD and autism. I was diagnosed when I was 36 and 38, respectively, which was really weird for me because I was like, why isn't my ADHD medication working? And my doctor was like, let's talk about autism. And I'm like, why would we talk about that thing? Because I don't have that thing. And well, let's actually talk about that. And 140 questionnaire or questionnaire later, fairly certain you have autism too. And I'm like, that's insane. And well, nope, they were right. So, I've been misdiagnosed with different issues all throughout my life. Before we found out it was ADHD, my original psychiatrist thought it was depression. The next psychiatrist thought it was bipolar disorder. And then I had a mental breakdown in 2016, which I ignored, obviously. I started taking medication for bipolar disorder. And then in 2018, actually, my body completely shut down, developed fibromyalgia, and actually wound up having to retire from being a project manager for of 12 years. And it was really frustrating because my body just had given up on me. And during this time, I'm newly diagnosed and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And then I wound up, my wife is pregnant with twins, and I have to be the provider of the family, right? That's what they tell you. And I wasn't able to be. My wife is a special needs teacher, and of course, she's been with me through this journey over the course of over a decade now. And the more I had learned about ADHD, the more I had learned about autism, the more I was like, what am I going to do? And then I finally started getting a lot better after a lot of therapy and working with a really good therapist who understood ADHD and autism. And I was really feeling lost. And so I kind of got into freelancing, which is where Creating Order from Chaos was born, was just freelance project management. I take chaotic stuff and I create order out of it. That's my thing. I enjoy doing it. But it wasn't enough for me. There was just things missing there. I wanted to help people, and I actually started working with an ADHD life coach. I wanted to find those different things that I could do because I didn't feel like there was enough in my life. And then, ironically enough, she kind of came to me and she was like, well, you love project management. You know so much about ADHD and autism. Why aren't you doing things with that? And I'm like, ADHD and project management, what does that have to do with anything? She goes, do you know what I do as a coach? And that was it. That was the starting point. That's where ADHD coaching came into play in my world. And I found my passion. I've always had that passion about ADHD. I've always found the brain hugely interesting from childhood on. But the more that I started understanding about how to help people, not just my personal story, because my personal story is pretty great and it has all the things that you look for, tragedy and drama and all that stuff, abusive first marriage, and then actually getting better, which was really weird for me to be able to sit here and say that. But I wanted to be able to give back to people. And then that was where I started getting involved with different organizations. Men's ADHD support group is one, right? Going with the creating order from chaos, I started getting into ADHD coaching and helping people. I started getting on podcasts. Thank you, by the way, for inviting me on this one.
No, the problem.
But I wanted to give back more, right? I wanted to give to people. And so I started working with a guy named Mark Almodovar of the Men's ADHD support group. And, you know, we have a Facebook group of over 17,000 members of men who were dealing with ADHD. And that was it. That was the thing I needed right there, was to be able to help people in giving men that space and being able to help them and be in the comment sections and run webinars and do things like that really just did it for me. And then we developed a nonprofit of the same name in 2022. And we've been just doing that. And I'm a chronic nonprofit helper. I am now on the board of Dueling Minds, which is an ADHD support group, a nonprofit that we just developed this year with Michael Ruffin. I spoke at the 2023 International ADHD Conference. I'm going to speak at the 2024 International ADHD Conference, and I'm actually on the marketing lead for the International ADHD Conference for this year as well. So I kind of just found ADHD and dove both feet into it, and I'm having the time of my life with it.
So you were diagnosed later in life?
Yes.
When you got diagnosed, did you all of a sudden your life start to make sense to you?
Oh my God, did it. There are so many things. For my dad was typical Southern gentleman kind of guy. I grew up in the deep South, rural Northeast Texas. My dad was an alcoholic and he was abusive. One of his favorite phrases for me was the dumbest smart kid he ever knew. And it wasn't so much, the ADHD made a lot of things make sense, but the autistic diagnosis made everything kind of go from like slightly fuzzy old HBO screen to like full high def for me. It was, oh, so learning body language to understand social situations isn't a normal thing a 12-year-old should do. Gotcha. Okay. Because that's how I learned body language, was we got our first computer when I was 12 and I watched Oprah, and Oprah had this guy come on who was a body language expert. And he said, you can learn everything about the minutiae of how a face makes certain muscle twitches. And my brain said, latched on that, let's go. And of course, Google wasn't around at the time, to date myself a little bit. This was in 1993. But, you know, Ask Jeeves and Alta Vista and all that stuff, AOL was the thing. And I started learning about body language, and that was it. That was how I started quantifying emotional output and input, was by body language and by making those things for my face to make sense. Like, oh, if that's a funny, I'm supposed to laugh. This is what laughter is supposed to look like. If I'm angry, this is what the face is supposed to look like. I have to make that face. And so it's a lot of time in front of a mirror looking at my face going, what can my face do? But it was also then paying attention to TV and seeing all the little micro expressions, which, by the way, watching TV, learning body language, not the best thing when an actor's not a good actor and their face actually isn't making the micro expressions. But that was it. That was the lens, right? That was what made everything make sense, was understanding those things about myself and then going, oh, so there's neurotypical people who do these things in this way, and there's neurodivergent people who with ADHD or autism or both who do things this way, and those are different, and I'm not broken. Oh, and that was it. That was the feeling right there. I'm not broken.
I think that's one of the biggest things a lot of us feel when we first get this diagnosis is, I'm broken. That's why you and I do what we do. So these people out there realize you're not broken. There are so many of us out there struggling with the same thing. You're not alone in this world. You're not broken. You just think differently. You view the world differently. One of my biggest issues is I can't tell when someone's joking. I used to sit at the dinner table with my father before he passed away, and we'd all be sitting there, and my brother would crack a joke, and I would fall right into it, and my dad would go, "You walk right into that." My mom would look at him and go, "You guys know he doesn't get jokes or sarcasm. Why do you do it?" And my brother's like, "Because it's funny."
Ironically enough, my wife actually helps me out with that a huge amount. And this is an agreed upon thing. And by the way, for those who have relationships, make sure it's agreed upon. But one of the things I told her when we first discovered this is like, "Hey, I need your help in social situations." And she's like, "What do you need?" I said, "I interrupt people a lot. I am overbearing and sometimes take off in a conversation about whatever esoteric thing that we happen to be talking about, especially if I'm passionate about it. I overtalk people and I sometimes don't get sarcasm. And I may start going off on a rant because I think a person is being serious. Can you just tap me on the leg if you think that I'm doing something like that and just give me a quick second to pause and think about if I'm doing something like that? Can you be my impulsivity control?" Right? And
yeah,
she does it in a really loving way. Now, why do I want her to do it that way? Because I have social phobias and I don't want to have social interactions like that seem like she's getting on to me in public, right? Because that's a big trauma issue from my childhood. But her tapping on the leg and looking at me lovingly is my cue. "Hey, I may be overstepping a few things. Let me take a quick 30-second review of everything that just happened." Cool. That took me 3.3 seconds. Cool. Mm-hmm. "Oh, I interrupted somebody. Crap. Hey, I'm so sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead and continue. I'll say what I need to say here in a second." And I'll pull my little notebook out and I'll scribble out what I was going to say, because that's the kind of things I've had to learn to help me manage those different issues that I have in those social situations. But we don't know those things at first.
No, we don't.
Which, again, is why we do what we do, is to help educate people on those kind of things.
I've had several situations in family dinners where I'd say something where in my mind I think it's funny, and it turned out hurtful, and the person wouldn't say anything, but they'd tell my parents. And then when we get home, I'd get an earful. But it also reminds me of a story. I used to volunteer at the planetarium here in Chicago. My supervisor, sweetest woman in the world, was autistic herself and her two kids. And I remember one time I was working what we called the after dark party. It was a party we'd have, an adult party we'd have every third Thursday of the month. And I was downstairs. I was coming up to change my shifts. And I saw these two elderly volunteers standing there, standing still, not doing nothing. So the first thing that pops in my mind is, "Hey, you're doing the new senior dance. It's called Standing Still." She smiled at me and she goes, "I'm going to get you when you least expect it, Reed." And then the next day I tell my supervisor about this, so she's aware of this. And she's like, "You did the good thing by telling me this, but it's also a good thing she was a former teacher. She's used to getting razz. So her telling you she's going to get you when you least expect it is her way of getting back at you."
Yeah. And it's a little stuff like that, that one of the things that my wife taught me is she's like, "You know, you can tell people those kinds of things about yourself, right?" And I'm like, "No, I can't." She goes, "No, you can." And I'm like, but like, then they're going to know that I have, she, and she's like, no, 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 it's okay. Because here's what's going to happen. Those people who understand will understand. Those people who don't want to or can't won't. And there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
And what you have to kind of start understanding is that you function differently, and that's okay. Tell people that. Give people the heads up ahead of time. And I think that was one of those moments where, you know, because we mask a lot early on and we learn about that throughout our lives, masking isn't necessarily a bad thing if we need that space to make sure that we feel safe. But at the same time, we can't let the mask become like a solid thing. It needs to be something that we use as a tool, not as a trauma response. Yeah. And, but by me being able to be a little bit more authentic with the people around me, and me being able to say, hey, just to give everybody a heads up, I have ADHD, which means I may interrupt you, or I may talk about something that like go like hardcore into it. It's totally cool to tell me to chill out and relax. And I actually need you to do that, because if you make any kind of social things that I should catch that are super subtle, not going to catch them because also autistic. And I'm going to miss those, including sarcasms, just to let y'all know. And the people who get it, and they're totally cool with it. The people who don't, I don't need them in my life, really. I can be I can be an associate of that person. I can work with that kind of person, but that's all you're ever going to be, really be to me, unless you can prove to me that you're a safe person, right?
And that's one of the main things I talk about in my book about friendship. Is there are going to be two types of friends you're going to have. There are going to be those who understand you and get you, and no matter what you do or what you say to them, they're going to stick with you to the end. Then there's those who, the minute you say something, they may find a little bit offensive, but don't know you 100%, and even know you 100%, just don't want to be associated with it. They will up and drop you at the blink of an eye because they think you're strange and weird, and they want nothing to do with you. Know who your friends are. It's the quality, not the quantity.
Yeah, that's the key right there, is the quality. And like, because as a friend, I was always really wigged out, because as a friend, I'm always ride or die. I'm like, oh, that person offended you. I know where to hide the body. Let's, you know, let's go. I'm ready. Let's go now. Like, no. Okay. That's fine. Whatever timetable you need, I got you. And I think one of the biggest struggles I had was those people who are just fake. Like the people who are just totally not authentic. And I don't even mean like masking in neurodivergence or anything like that, but like the people who like to talk about you behind your back, or the people who like to say one thing to you, but then they go around and they say other things to other people. I don't understand that. I don't even like, why? What's the point? What's the point in being that way towards people? Like, I just want people to be very upfront with me, which, frankly, is why most of my friends are neurodivergent of some sort. So, and my wife's a special needs teacher, so she gets a pass.
Yeah. I mean, I've got certain friends that who understand me. I got certain friends who don't. But a good percentage of my friends are neurodivergent. Anyways. You said you have four kids. Are your kids neurodivergent as well?
My oldest daughter has ADHD. I'm fairly certain my oldest son is on the autism spectrum, but his mother was not very open to testing or has any inclination for mental health support at all. He was diagnosed with ADHD at 8, but they never did anything with it. My two youngest children, the 5-year-old toddlers, they were born at 27 weeks. And so we had, we have multiple different issues that were kind of still like percolating through the system, but we kind of just started on the mindset that they were going to be neurodivergent and just gave them the support from birth on. We're also lucky because here in North Carolina, if any kind of premature birth or anything like that comes with a full suite of therapy support that follows the children all the way through age 5. And so we've had a really big support structure for the children all the way through till now and beyond. My youngest daughter has a mild CP diagnosis, cerebral palsy diagnosis. And so, you know, there's a lot of those different things that we deal with as far as they're concerned. My oldest two are actually fairly well adjusted. They've got really good heads on their shoulders. My oldest son just turned 21 on the 23rd, and I actually got to go see him, and I got to go see my oldest daughter graduate with her diploma and her associate's degree.
Good for her. Congratulations. Now, let's talk a little bit about you for a minute. How are you with facial expressions? Can you read them? I have a hard time.
I think it's because practice, right? When I sit here and say I've been doing this since I was 12, I've literally been doing this since I was 12. And I mean, it was really hard at first, obviously, because first off, children and teenagers do not have the same facial expressions as adults. And if you're learning things from things that you're reading about on the thing, it's always based on adults with fully formed emotional input, output kind of things. For me, it was generally not just facial expressions, but body language overall. Like every micro expression that the body makes is something that means something, whether or not the person meant it to or not, which kind of can be problematic because it gives me a pretty strong BS meter as well. And kind of going back to those people who say one thing and then turn around and say other things, I recognize those people early on. I recognize the villain of the story very early on. I recognize all these different things, which kind of takes a lot of the joy out of life. There's no surprises, but at the same time, there's no surprises, and that's a good thing sometimes in my book. But, you know, it's not perfect. It's not foolproof. Neurodivergent people also, the reason I enjoy being around them, can't read them the same way as I can other people because we don't look each other in the eye. but, you know, it definitely does help me because it gives me something to recognize whenever I actually may be causing harm. Right? When I see the sinking of the shoulders and the kind of retreating into themselves. All right, what did I just say I'm being really loud. That's a problem. I have voice modulation in person, or seeing the frustration if I interrupt a person, recognizing the frustration, taking that quick second to do a reel back in my brain. Oh, crap, I just interrupted them. It helps me in a lot of those little ways, but everything is quantified. It's not a emotional, oh, I interrupted you, I'm so sorry. It's a quantified, frustration image. Why did I frustrate them? I interrupted them. Crap. Proper social response. Apologize. Sorry about that. Now, do I mean it? Yes, because I do legitimately feel bad for interrupting that person. But at the same time, it's not the emotional crap. It's the logical recognition to an emotional response that's appropriate for the situation, which for my brain is a logical progression. Not a emotional progression, which a lot of people don't really recognize because I've been doing it for so long. And they're like, you're perfectly emotional. I was like, no, I'm a goddamn good robot.
Anyways, we were talking earlier about people who tend to go on tangents and things and whose brains are going a mile a minute. And you said you have a way of dealing with that. Let's talk about that.
Ooh, I need more context.
How do you deal with a client whose mind is going a mile a minute and they can't focus on one particular thing and they're just a mess wherever they go? They got too many things going on, and how do you get them to focus on that one task so they complete it in time?
I'm trying to figure out, like, why, right? Now, in a conversation, I actually am going to let them ramble for about 5 minutes. Let them get it out of their system, especially if it's very at the very beginning. You know, sometimes they just have so much on their brain that they can't get themselves to stop. And so they actually just need to kind of, you know, get it out of their system and get it everything said and get all the frustration and the anger or the stress or the happiness or joy, whatever emotional, you know, thing that they're dealing with out. And then they're more receptive to what they want to the conversation. You know, when it comes to like task management and stuff like that, things along those lines, one of the things that I really try to get people to recognize is understanding how the ADHD brain works, right? You know, a lot of people have this really, really strict idea that when I'm supposed to focus on a task, even with ADHD, I'm supposed to just focus on that task and do that thing. The problem is that's not how our brains work, right? Neurotypical brains, whenever we're thinking about this, and this is something that I learned from Dr. Ned Hallowell.
Good man.
Whenever you have a task that you want to do, a neurotypical brain has, you know, the same parts as the person with ADHD. There's the default mode network, and then there's the task positivity system, right? And for neurotypical people, whenever the task positivity system is on, the default mode network is off or significantly reduced. So they're not daydreaming and all that stuff. They have kind of a general focus on the thing that they want to get done. And the person with ADHD, however, doesn't. When their task positivity system is on, so is their default mode network. And so instead of a narrow focused attention span, we have a shotgun blast of everything. ADHD is literally one of the worst named issues out there. It's not that we have a deficit of attention. We have a deficit of focus on the details that matter. And that's those things that people really need to understand about ADHD. And combine that with our understanding of what Dr. Bill Dodson talks about with the importance-based mindset and a interest-based mindset. Neurotypical people have an importance-based mindset. I think this is important, so I do that thing for that reward. My boss thinks this is important, so I do that thing for that reward, right? It's very linear, right? Somebody thinks this is important, I do that thing, I get a reward. With people with ADHD, though, we have an interest-based mindset. And so it's based around novelty, interest, challenging us, urgency, passions. Those are the things that motivate us. And so when we sit here and we talk about ADHD, a lot of people sit here and say, it's an, you know, executive dysfunction issue. I'm like, it's an executive dysfunction issue up until the point that you find something that a person with ADHD is interested in, and then there's no deficit. So let's not use executive dysfunction as a part of this, because it doesn't really fit. What the issue is the motivation factor is different for people with ADHD than it is for neurotypical people. Because the second you get us something that we're interested in, that we find novel, that is challenging us in the way that we enjoy, that has an urgency that we can understand and follows our passions, we're perfectly capable of doing amazing things. But the problem is we live in a neurotypical society. It's based around importance-based mindsets, and that works differently for us. We don't care about the reports that you need, Bob. We have this new shiny stapler that's on our desk that I really enjoy. So, what I do there is I just help people recognize those two different systems and to focus on finding the way to make the things that they want to do or that they need to get done fall into that interest-based mindset that revolves around NICUP, novelty, interesting, challenging, urgency, passion, and then develop systems that work in that realm.
All right. Now, what do you see when working with people who have ADHD, what do you see as one of the biggest struggles that they deal with?
Emotional dysregulation. It's the number one problem. Actually, I think it's probably the root problem of most issues that people with ADHD deal with. Because we feel things more, right? ADHD affects the limbic system, the emotional center of our brain. The amygdala is constantly activated, which means our anxiety is constantly nuts. We develop PTSD and complex PTSD at a hugely higher rate. 80% of people with ADHD and or autism have some sort of trauma, PTSD, comorbidity. Anxieties are dramatically higher for people with ADHD, depression, borderline personality disorder. Run across the entire gamut of mental health issues, and people with ADHD deal with them more because our brains process emotions in different ways, and trauma responses are probably one of the more significant issues that we struggle with. And because we develop trauma at a higher rate, we develop trauma at a much lower threshold. So what may be traumatic for us may not be traumatic for a neurotypical person, but it is for us because of just how our brains take in the world around us, how we experience the world. You said that earlier, remember? Like, we experience the world differently.
We
experience the world differently. So when you kind of combine that with just growing up in the culture that we often do, that has such a lack of understanding of neurodiversity and neurodivergence, then we deal with emotional dysregulation because we are constantly traumatized by different things. And we very rarely learn at a young enough age how to process those emotions in healthy ways. And then we grow up as adults with severe emotional dysregulation issues in things like rejection sensitivity or rejection sensitivity dysphoria or imposter syndrome. And these issues cripple us in so many different ways. So that's definitely one of those things that I think is literally the root of most issues that people with ADHD and autism face.
All right. Now, do you feel that those who get diagnosed with ASD and ADHD, they kind of get misdiagnosed because of the overlapping traits?
I think so. I think one of the things that I learned from my psychiatrist about why it took so much time to figure out that I had autism was because they had originally thought that it was social anxiety, right? And, you know, the thing with a social anxiety, though, especially if it's caused by ADHD, is when the ADHD medications go into effect, they affect the limbic system, right? They help us actually regulate our emotions better. And because they help us regulate our emotions better, a lot of people who originally were thought to have anxiety see those anxieties go away, but mine never did. And that was where the doctor started wondering about if there was autism at play, because the anxieties that I was dealing with were not going away with the ADHD medications, and so therefore they were still there. And he started asking me a lot of questions about how overwhelmed did I feel in social situations. And I'm like, if there's social situations where I don't have control over it, like if I'm not doing the public speaking, or if I'm not leading the conversation, or if I'm not running the meeting, I'm a hot fucking mess. However, if I'm in control of the situation and I'm able to run it the way that I see fit, and I'm able to like do the public speaking where I'm able to disassociate from the crowd or things like that, I'm fine. And those were some keys that really led him to kind of go into that realm of, okay, it doesn't sound like social anxiety actually, right? It actually sounds like you may have some issues with making sure that you have control in the space so that you can do it in a specific methodology that works for you, that runs through your logical processes. And I said, that's it. He goes, that's autism. Well, that's a that is a spectrum of autism that we had to explore. And it then turned out that I had that level of autism.
That's funny. It kind of reminds me of when I went to my first podcast conference. I went there with the expectations of no one's going to talk to me. I'm not going to talk to anybody. I'm going to go there, do my thing, and come home. Boy, was I wrong. I get there, and I just start talking with anyone who pops in the elevator wearing a badge. I'm like, are you here for the conference? Are you a vendor or a podcaster? And then I remember one day I'm standing by the elevator at the end of the day from what, and a whole bunch of people are behind me now. We're all waiting for an elevator. And I make this joke of going, all right, because I'm in Vegas. I'm like, all right, everybody, let's make a bet. Which elevator bay is it going to be? Is it going to be 1, 2, or 3? And I take a pause and everyone just starts laughing. And I realize, hey, we're all here for the same thing. We're all like-minded people.
Yep. Oh, my tribe has arrived. I think that was one of the things I really enjoyed about the International ADHD Conference was a lot of that was, you know, just recognizing that I have certain tics, and actually, if y'all are watching the video, you may have actually just saw one go off, like where my hands do a thing, right? It's like always winds up doing this weird thing. And the social stress tick, and I don't really have any real control over it. And it's always been a source of shame for me because like all my public speaking things are like, hey, you need to make sure you're doing something with your hands that makes your speaking, like bring people into it. And like this doesn't do that. But, and so there was like all this source of shame, but then like going to the conference and being around people who really got it, and especially like people who have other tic issues like Tourette's and things along those lines, people who get it, who don't make a big deal out of it or even make jokes about it because it's just a part of who we are. It's just like, it's a thing that's accepted and not, and I don't mean making fun of jokes. I mean, like legitimately are dark humor kind of things. And like just being around people who get it and makes me feel so much more comfortable. And like, and I feel my social batteries, instead of them draining constantly at those places, they seem to recharge. Yeah, absolutely. And it's where I started kind of figuring out my spaces are just neurodivergent spaces where people get it. And even if it's neurotypical people who are there and they are there because they're learning and they actually want to understand and get it, like those are the people I can be around. Those people who are starting to understand boundaries and understand how to express their boundaries and understand boundaries, and people who like have that same kind of dark humor and tell those jokes and that I understand, and people who use the sarcasm and actually emote the sarcasm in ways that I understand. Like those are those spaces where I really find myself thriving. And, you know, and I know a lot of people out there struggle with social situations. In fact, the men's group just had a good discussion on relationships just recently. But like, it's all about finding your people, right? Neurotypical or neurodivergent alike. Just find the people who understand and accept you for who you are, and then just live that life with those people and just be there for them the way that they need you, and just ask them to be there the way that you need them to be.
All right. We talked a little bit about you, but now let's talk a little bit about creating order from chaos. How did that come to be?
Yeah, like I said earlier, it was just a desire to do something, right? And so in 2018, when my body kind of just decided up and crash and burn on me, and I developed fibromyalgia, I actually had a really good pain management doctor who, you know, you can't really treat fibromyalgia with pain medication, especially if you have an addiction issue like I do. And so opioids were my addiction of choice when I was much younger. And so I've always had to stay away from opioids. And I also didn't want to just drug myself senseless because I didn't want to drug myself senseless. And so they were just like, you have to manage your stress and frustration levels to a degree that you've probably never done before in your life. And I was like, look, doc, I'm not going to be doing some yoga like that, like mindfulness or not mindfulness, but meditation stuff. He's like, no, you won't, because you have ADHD. You have to find a system that works for you that's in that realm of mindfulness, but understandably has a basis in understanding ADHD. And I said, okay, well, that's a new research subject for me. By the way, that stuff does exist out there. It's awesome. Mine happens to be journaling. I know that's a bad word in some of our realms, but you know, writing actually is that Zen place for me. It's the place that really does it for me. And that's where Creating Order from Chaos came from, was my writing, was me sitting here brainstorming all of the different things that I wanted to do. Right? Now, granted, ADHD coaching was kind of off the table. I hadn't really learned a whole lot about it at this time, but like, what did I want to do? What could I do? Well, I'm a project manager by trade, 12 years, done it for multiple companies like Cisco and Duke Energy and other companies like that. All right, cool. That's a nebulous thing. All right. What does that mean? You know, it's like, okay, so let's dig into it. Like, what kind of stuff do I want to work on? I'm huge in social media. I love working on social media stuff. So social media management kind of fit under that umbrella. So I'm taking somebody's chaotic mess of social media, or lack of, and making something really structured that posts on a regular basis. Cool. Check. All right. Website design. I took 2 years of website design in college. Let's go ahead and use that knowledge and use it. All right. So I'll take somebody's chaotic mess from a website and I'll make something really cool out of it. All right. Website design. That's under there. And it was just, you know, public speaking. I want to do public speaking of some sort. Let's do it on leadership and education. Again, this is before ADHD. Now ADHD is the public speaking I do. I want to do business development. All right. I want to help people create businesses. All right. So what else does this mean? And everything in it. And my ADHD coach kind of saw it, and she's like, so it just looks like all you do is you take a lot of really chaotic stuff and make something ordered out of it. And I said, create order from chaos. And that was where the name was born. It was literally in this moment of inspiration after having written down all the different things that I wanted to do. And it really does encompass a full understanding of my ADHD brain. I know I'm going to get bored with website development eventually. So I need to have an infrastructure in place that allows me to do that. And then if I'm done doing it, turn off those parts of my website and then move into another part of my website and use that to promote, which is completely counterintuitive to what neurotypical business developers, by the way, say. They say you're supposed to find your niche and you dig in and you do that thing. Cool. I got you for 2 years and that's it, you know? And that was actually a lesson I learned early on when I was 25. I learned early on I was not a person who's going to be working at one job for 30 years until I retired or died. My normal jobs, I bounce from job to job to job. So at 25, I said, you know what? I'm going to lean right into that. What can I do? And I said, I'm a good project manager. So I'll just find projects that I can do that are 3 to 8 months long, and I'll just do those. At first, I was like, I don't think that's a thing. But then I started looking into it, and that was a thing. And so then I started just diving into it. I went to headhunters. I said, I'm looking for short-term contract project management positions. It was very specific. I said, they can't be any shorter than 3 months, and they can't be any longer than 8 months. And that's why on my resume, it looks like I have 70 fucking jobs, because I did.
And that kind of reminds me, I had once went to a market research, and it was on career development. And I'm sitting there, and they go, okay, we want you all to go up against the wall and write down every single job you have. And I'm here with two, three jobs. And then I'm looking around, and all these young 20-somethings have like 10, 20 jobs listed. I'm like, I call over to the person. And I'm like, I feel out of place here. She's like, why? I'm like, I only have one or two jobs. These guys have 10, 20 jobs. She's like, are these jobs you stuck with? I'm like, yeah. Then she's like, then you are in the right place. You changed jobs. These guys just did it more often. They couldn't find out what they liked.
And that actually speaks to a little bit about marketing. It's the type of jobs that people with ADHD find themselves in most often. And the same thing goes for people with autism, and the same thing goes for people who have autism, ADHD. Like, we all have these different genre of jobs that we all kind of like all fall into, right? A lot of autistic people fall into positions that are either tech heavy or very structured, very like function based. Let's do these things, very specific instructions, very clear laid out platforms. And they're really good at those things because they don't want a whole lot of people involved with them. They're not team based people. They can work within a team, but they don't necessarily need a team. People with ADHD, they tend to have these really dynamic jobs that have a lot of really interesting things. Like, we see them in EMTs, emergency rooms, entertainers, actors, creatives, artists, and different things that really activate that adrenaline, and really we enjoy that kind of thing. And then you have the ADHD autistic people who are just like kind of like wander into all of these different realms. Until they find the thing that's both A, creative, and B, structured. And they start playing around in those different realms. A lot of teachers actually probably fall into that realm, and a lot of different like project managers, a lot of different business developers, CEOs all kind of fall into that realm where there's a very specific structure that's needed or hierarchy that's needed. But at the same time, there's a certain level of creativity and impulsivity and imagination that's needed as well. And so, yeah, we're out there, y'all. We're just usually the bosses.
Now, when it comes to men and women, who do you see struggling more with ADHD?
Oh, that's a. That's a hard question, and I really like it. Oh man.
Know with ASD, it's the women get along better than the men because they are easier to adapt to masking where the men don't mask early on.
I actually think that's completely it's no, it's not that. No. I gotta disagree on that one. Women do find it easier to mask than men, but that's because we live in a patriarchal society where the women are told that there's a very specific space that they're supposed to fill in, and then they're not supposed to do anything else. But I think it's actually just as hard for men because there's a very specific space that men are supposed to fill, and if they don't, then they're a failure and they're weak. Whereas, if you're a woman, you're just uppity, right? And I think it's really frustrating when I see the differences there. And the struggles that women have is actually due to misdiagnosis often because of always being put into the anxiety box or something along those lines. Whereas with men, a lot of us fall into the bipolar box or something, or depression box. And a lot of people just don't really take the time to understand that women and men present differently. And it is, like you said, actually, because women mask in certain ways that are much more relevant to their what people's expectations of them are, whereas men who mask in those ways, in the ways that they see taught around them in their culture and things of that nature, often go to extreme levels of that thing. So it's not that women don't mask well, they just mask the way that they're supposed to, whereas men take it to the extreme, and you see a lot of different toxic traits that really get expounded upon. And I'll use my Southern United States roots here. I was taught that A, I was supposed to be racist because all of other races were inferior. That's what I was taught. right? I was taught that gay people were wrong. I was taught that if you didn't follow Jesus, that you were going to hell. I was taught all these different things, and I can definitely tell you that there's a number of people in my family who were on the spectrum who took that full-throated whole hog and went to town on it and became raging racist assholes. Whereas I never saw those things as being a thing I wanted to be, because I want to be empathetic. And a lot of people may not understand this, that people with ASD, autism, it's not that we're not empathetic. Sometimes it's because we have too much empathy and it's too overwhelming for us to feel those emotions that everybody is shoving at us all the time. And so we shut that emotion side down for a chunk of us. Sometimes we don't process it in the same way, so we have a different emotional output than people expected because we process it differently. But the thing is I couldn't be that kind of person. And for me to be that kind of person meant that I would have to go against the fundamental aspect of who I was. However, some people with ADHD, they take that expectation of who and what they're supposed to be, and they go to that extreme and they mask so severely that they go to the other end of the spectrum of rude and things of that nature. And it's because they think that that's what they're supposed to be, then they can, especially if there's autism in the mix, they get very dogmatic in that belief, that black and white view of the world. And, that's where we see a lot of the struggle with men, where we have to deprogram all of that stuff back, right, and come back to it. Whereas with women, it's about lifting them up and making sure that they feel heard and that they're expressions are understood and that their value is praised and understood and respected. Whereas men, it's like, hey, we don't want you to feel disrespected. We want you to have a space. We just need you to understand that there are healthy ways to have emotions that aren't anger and rage. And I think, sorry, that's a long answer for what you asked, and I apologize, but
No, it's okay.
that's how I see the differences in the gender identities.
Now, how do you help those with ADHD with things like executive functioning?
It's all about educating. It's all about learning about how your ADHD affects you. Because, like, if you've met one person with ADHD and/or autism, you've met one person with ADHD and/or autism. And our brains work really differently. And for anybody, there's no cookie cutter solution for anybody out there. So a lot of my initial work with people is to first make sure that they're working with a doctor and a therapist if they have access to them. Like to help them walk them through that process, get them in there, get them, educated on how ADHD actually works. And then once they've started working through therapy and started really processing a lot of that emotional needs that they need met, I'm not a therapist, I'm a coach. And so a lot of people really don't understand that when it comes to managing ADHD, the medication is the thing that really helps us a lot, as well as like exercise. Finding different ways to be mindful, creativity, things of that nature. That's what really helps us with a lot of our executive function, time blindness, and different issues like that. Therapy is to help us with all of the different trauma and emotional issues that we've developed over the years. Not necessarily specifically ADHD, but because of all the different emotional things that we need help with. We need to understand emotions in a healthy way. We need to express them in different ways that really help us like have a better understanding of them. We have to recognize triggers. We have to recognize when we are going to erupt or feel overwhelmed and are burnt out. We have to work through all those different things. I come in as a coach and help you put in place those practical aspects of life, like time management systems. Like, how do we measure time when we don't have a concept of time? Well, we have to use a tool like Siri or Alexa or making sure we have calendars that are in place. Like I help people develop systems that help them understand their ADHD and how it functions with them and how they can be productive at the level that they're capable of being productive at. not at the level that society has forced them to think that they should be productive at. And there's a giant, giant gulf of difference between those two things.
All right. Let's talk. You talked about a men's group that you're a part of and that you're a big part of. Tell me about it. And do you know how it got started and how does someone get involved with it?
Yeah, Mark Almodovar is the founder and president of the Men's ADHD Support Group. He was diagnosed at 16 with ADHD, and he was really young. He was really trying to figure out how he could kind of be more into that space. He was an influencer, and he just had the idea that, you know, walking through the park of like, why don't I just create a men's group? Because I've seen all these other ones that are out there that are co-ed and stuff like that. But where can men who are dealing with issues like with Strattera and erectile dysfunction, where can those men go to talk about that kind of stuff? Nowhere safe on the internet for that kind of conversation. And so in 2019, he developed a Facebook group, and it started off really small, but then during COVID, it really blew up. It went from being just a little bit under 100 to over 7,000 during COVID. And then after COVID, you know, he just kept expanding the group. He built up an entire team of people who are experts in ADHD and education, in different fields of relationships and you know, therapy. And, you know, he started building a network of people who understood the issues that men go through, and men with ADHD and men with ADHD and autism go through. And he had brought me on board at this time, by this time. And it was just really about developing that space. And then in 2022, when we decided to create the nonprofit, it expanded into doing a lot more public speaking, a lot more podcasting, a lot more content on the social media, and different things of that nature. And now we have monthly, you know, guest speakings by different people in the field. We've had Dr. Bill Dotson came on and did a three-part webinar for us. Dr. Carolyn Lynch-Parcells came on and did a webinar for about medication. You know, we had Dr. Roberto Olivardia come on and talk about food and ADHD. And then we had David O'Dwyer recently talk about relationships along with his fiance Laura. And it's just been one of those things where having this nonprofit where we're raising money and we're able to be able to use that money to bring more and more awareness about ADHD and autism and other types of neurodivergence in regards to men has been really rewarding. Because part of it is also getting men, like I was talking about earlier, to get away from that toxic mentality that a lot of them developed over the years from the emotional dysregulation and unrealistic social expectations and cultural expectations of what a man was supposed to be, and really redefining that whole concept of masculinity to include being emotional in healthy ways and being able to ask for help to other men and not feel shame and guilt for it, and to be able to talk about things that they struggle with in a safe environment and know that there's going to be people watching out to make sure that that environment stays safe, which is like a lot of what we do as the admins for the Facebook group, is to make sure that those spaces where men who come in and talk about those issues know that there's not going to be somebody that's going to be in the comment section talking about just buck up and be a man about it. Like we're not like total tyrants, but we are pretty strict about stuff like that, where we're going to have conversations with that person. Like, look, you can't just tell a person to man up because that's what they've been trying to do, right? You know, we want trans men, you know, who are transitioning or have transitioned, to have a space to go and talk about the issues that they deal with as trans men and not get bullied for being trans men. Right. And so we've created the space for, you know, men of all types to come into, to be a part of. And we have weekly meetings that everybody's allowed to go to that are completely free on Zoom, where we talk about a specific subject. Right. Like we're getting ready. We just had Brendan Mahan come on and did one on fatherhood, where it was just us generally talking around the table about being fathers and being future fathers and stuff like that. So it's just a really good environment that I think is really healthy, and I think it's really encouraging to see certain posts that come up quite often in our group about men sitting here saying, this is one of the best and supportive groups I've ever been a part of. Like, this is better than my WoW group. And I'm like, yes. You know what I mean? World of Warcraft for y'all non-nerds out there.
Anyway, what advice do you have for those who are getting diagnosed late in life?
Get ready to rewrite the entire narrative around your life, man. Make sure you're working with your psychiatrist. Make sure you're working with a therapist. Make sure that they are ADHD informed, and really, really understand that you are going to relearn a lot of stuff about yourself that you didn't know before. Right? We get trapped so much in the shame and guilt and the feeling I'm broken and stuff like that. And one of the biggest things that you need to take away from this conversation and future conversations that you hear on this podcast is that you're not broken. You are not a broken neurotypical person. You are a perfectly functioning person with ADHD who works slightly different than the norm. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. You have to redefine and figure out what that is for you, and then start functioning and living your life the way that works best for you. And just take your time. You know, life is a marathon.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and the men's group?
So you can find more about me at creatingorderfromchaos.com or Creating Order from Chaos Consulting on any of the social media. You can find the men's ADHD support group, and this is super imaginative, and I know it, but it's at the men's ADHD support group org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Men's ADHD Support Group. We literally trademarked the name so that people can't use it. But yeah, we're anywhere you find men's ADHD support group, that's probably us.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Reed Miles. That was Shane, and I'll see you in the next one. Thank you, Shane.